If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am your host, Brandon, and I'm joined today by Hale. Today we're going to be talking a bit about Martin Heidegger, who is a early 20th into mid-20th century German thinker, largely associated with the existentialist movement, though I don't think Heidegger would appreciate being very associated with that. But he absolutely was involved in currents of phenomenology and continental philosophy. He more or less lays the groundwork for, or at least the texts that he produced, such as Being and Time, sort of lay the groundwork for a lot of the interests of the continental tradition. So things like deconstruction sort of get started with this, predated by Nietzsche as well. But deconstruction definitely gets its main start with Heidegger. But today we're going to be talking a bit about something a bit different in terms of Heidegger's thought. This is more or less the... I think that in terms of how most people encounter Heidegger or when they try to start reading Heidegger and taking him seriously, I think this is the current that a lot of people encounter, and it's this idea of being in the world or an integrated sense of oneself in any given environment or something like that, especially a pushback against what is seen as a kind of dualism or not an explicit metaphysically laid out dualism, but there's nevertheless this kind of specter of Cartesianism laying behind all kinds of currents of thought that Heidegger wants to point out and say, that's actually what's going on there, but that's not really the truth. So Hale found this great article. I mean, we've been going through a collection that he has.
It's a collection called A Stone Reader, Modern Ethics and 77 Arguments. Just for our listeners, some of you might already be familiar with it because we have taken up a few of these essays, but it's actually a collection of what are effectively short New York Times published philosophy essays, generally done by, you know, established academic philosophers throughout the US and Europe and stuff like that. But they're, if any of the listeners are interested, they're all quite short and accessible and have a very broad range of topics. So it's a really interesting book if you're looking to read some philosophy, but have it be relatively accessible and kind of casual in that reading, which is kind of funny that there's an essay on Heidegger who's famously not casual or accessible.
Yeah. But one of the veins that a lot of people tap into when they read Heidegger is this idea of being in the world and this idea of an agent or a being sort of integrated with its world. I think one of the reasons that that is such a, because there's lots to talk about with Heidegger, but I think that one of the reasons that that is so well trodden in terms of the lay scholarship or the way that people read it is because of some of the introductory readings like Hubert Dreyfus's Being in the World. That's one of the primary concerns that Dreyfus has, is to paint that picture of how it is that there isn't really this radical split between us and the beings that we are involved with, that we pervade the world in ways that are quite counterintuitive, but only to a very strange way of thinking that only seems strange if you have someone to help explain why that picture is so strange, like Hubert Dreyfus.
I always found, as a student of philosophy, one of the big philosophical revolution or realization for me, and why Heidegger had such a big impact on my education, and I think he has this impact on many people, is he really sort of flipped on its head the way we generally understand ourselves and our relationship to the world. Mm-hmm. And as you already kind of pointed that out with, like, it would seem that the most intuitive way of thinking about things would be, I'm a psychological being, like, there's Hale, there's me, there's, like, inside my mind, yeah, right? There's some discrete you. Yeah, that discrete, like, most basic, fundamental psychological entity that's me, and I'm kind of trapped in my head. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure for our listeners, like, we're all kind of familiar with our, like, in what we might call internal selves.
Yeah.
As we'll get into it, like, one of the most kind of interesting, incredible things with Heidegger is really pointing out the fact that that's a reductive second order sense of oneself. Like, really, you're out in the world.
Yeah.
Like, you exist doing stuff in activities, in relationships, in concerns, in what Heidegger would broadly call the state of care. Mm-hmm. We don't need to get into all the technical lingo that I'm, you know, less familiar with now. For me as a student was really like a kind of whoa moment. Like, yeah, it makes, once you really get into it, it makes so much more sense. You know, the metaphor that I've heard many people use, including profs when I was kind of learning about this stuff, was it's kind of like trying to notice the glasses on your face. Mm. When you're wearing them, when you're engaged with them, when you're using them, they're so close to you. It's already so much a part of you that it's a hard thing to notice that, like, hey, actually, like, really, in my day-to-day, I exist, like, out in the world doing stuff with things, concerned with activities and having relationships. And that's, like, so blatantly obvious. Yeah. Like, I've often heard people call Heidegger platitudinal.
Right.
That, like, you completely miss it. Mm. And instead, we jump right into the, like, oh, well, I noticed that I have this conversation going on in my head that nobody else can engage with. That must be me.
Yeah. No, that is Heidegger's platitude. No, I think that's pretty funny. I mean, that makes him sound like he's kind of just saying something obvious, but the whole point is to bring up the obvious, to say it in a way that is kind of, there's a veil that Heidegger puts in his language between you and what is so familiar. He really wants you to, and I mean, you know, people will accuse Heidegger of being obscurantist or something like that. I think that the way he's writing can effectively achieve the goal that he's out for, which is to bring you to that familiarity in a sort of uncanny experience. I do think that it's kind of ironic that a lot of people praise Heidegger for introducing lots of new language for these things, because that language just puts it at a distance. It's more or less there to just indicate what is really there and to bring you to that experience. So I don't know. I just find the interest in all the jargon that Heidegger has produced to be kind of in line with the metaphysical or analytical way of seeing things. Like, people really get it, like, wow, he's got all this language and now we can point to stuff. Okay, well, you have to be distant from something to point at it. What he's pointing at is what you're in the middle of. I just go into this more or less as a, well, it's an introduction, but it's also an introduction to what we're going to be talking about, which is this article from The Stone. There is an article by Lawrence Berger titled Being There, Heidegger on Why Our Presence Matters. And it starts exactly the way that we've been talking about, is this distinction between what in Lawrence is specifically talking about. He brings up cognitive science and the way that the cognitive sciences seem to have this dualism inherent in them in terms of what is really out there and our cognitive mental representation, right? Within the culture, this is a pretty familiar idea that, you know, we're biased. Our minds are just kind of filters for the world. We don't actually have access to the things in themselves. And if we do, that's kind of just a grandiose illusion that we think we've got some kind of God's eye view on things.
In many ways, this way of thinking has become the standard way of characterizing our logical lives. Mm-hmm. Where, like, it's even in common conversation, you'll hear people quite often talk about if they're going through something, you know, let's say they're going through some sort of disturbance, or they're emotionally upset or whatever it might be, or, you know, if they're dealing with anxiety or depression are, like, great examples. you know, it becomes a biological process. It's a physiological process. There's things happening in your mind, you know, chemically, neurologically speaking. And, you know, we kind of default now, like the perspective in society, our perspective of existence is now to default to like, that's the real, right? What's real is the material intricacies going on in your mind.
Yeah.
Right. That then are projected out into form some sort of coherent world through your senses and through, as Lawrence talks about, through your attention, how it all combines into a certain sort of attention that really is just all can be sort of traced back to physiological processes.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, some of them can, but what Heidegger here is talking about is not, it doesn't even really touch that level. Like, you can affect your experience if you have certain biological states, but even once you manipulate those, or you're in some other, you know, you're stressed versus relaxed or something like that, that cashes out to a real difference in experience, something irreducible to, you know, any given cortisol level or something like that.
Yeah, I think that there's, I think sometimes there's this sort of criticism of Heidegger or other persons who you know, take interest in this, in the more phenomenological way of perceiving things, that what you're saying is that, oh, these biological, these physiological, these psychological processes, they're not actually real, like that they're not important. And I think the way I prefer to look at it and think about it, and I think what Lawrence is doing in his article, is saying that it's not that they're not real. They obviously are.
Yeah.
Right. It's that they're not primary.
Yeah.
It's not like first and initially how we are embedded in our world, how we actually experience our lives, how we actually experience our relationships and our activities. Those sorts of explanations are often reductive. And a lot of times, aren't actually all that meaningful in terms of what the person's experience actually is.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about this before on the show, but it's like, you know, if someone comes to you and is like, you know, my partner just died, I've lost my job, I'm in a huge rut, da, 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 da. And someone kind of says to you, oh, well, you know, you evolved to, you know, have an emotional partner and they're gone, so obviously you're upset. And, you know, your serotonin levels have probably dumped from everything that you've gone through. So, yeah, like, that's what's going on for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those things, like, those might be facts that are actually the case, but they aren't really reflective of how one is sort of embedded or being in the world, in this case, with the things that they're dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that you put it, that those things aren't primary, they're secondary, I think that really captures it, considering that if, like, let's say someone had something going on, like if they were depressed, I mean, people get sad all the time and that's completely normal, but a depressed person is sad for an unusual and disruptive amount of time. They can't get out of whatever they're in and they can't move on with their life. So at that point, there's something wrong. And then you would move into some kind of secondary, you know, neurobiological, then you might look into their serotonin and they might get SSRIs after that point. But it's only after you have an encounter with some qualitative experience like depression, and when things are going wrong in your world, that you start to try to figure things out behind the scenes, as it were. I mean, there are many cases in Being and Time where essentially Heidegger just says that many of the philosophical concepts we have are just a result of our breakdown of our being in the world, knowing as a kind of disruption in our ability to pervade through the world.
Speaking of pervading through the world and talking, you know, in Lawrence's article, you talk specifically about attention, right?
Yes.
Like, and as we've kind of said with, you know, the standard more, what I call psychological or scientific understanding of attention, you know, like we say, it's a kind of brain process. It's a filtering mechanism that sort of organizes the world in a coherent manner. But obviously Heidegger has this much more like embedded and relational understanding of attention. And I'm sure we want to get into that more. And I think I actually want to read something very briefly from the article.
Sure, yeah.
that it's actually a quote from Heidegger, but it's in Lawrence's article, and he's talking specifically about like how do we understand a tree. And I thought it was a really good kind of hint at where Heidegger is going. We are today rather inclined to favor a supposedly superior physical and psychological knowledge, and to drop the blooming tree. Matters first and foremost is not to drop the tree in bloom, but for once to let it stand where it stands. To this day, thought has never let the tree stand where it stands. Somewhat standard cryptic Heidegger with flourishes about, you know, natural phenomena. Mm-hmm. But I think that was, I guess we're going to get into it, I'm sure, like this sort of idea of the phenomena that we primarily encounter, you know, like always already embedded with, like, instead of trying to reduce it to some scientific quality, like what is the phenomena when it's just there, mm-hmm. when our attention is on, is just with it or on it or engaged?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the point for, and the upshot of all of this for Lawrence is that this kind of attention leads to a presence that, or the presence of a being or an entity or something that one is encountering in one's world that can't be reproduced or can't be accounted for. Well, it can be accounted for if you go to a kind of neurobiological, like, okay, maybe there are presence centers in the brain or something like that. You can just create some variable like that, sure. But that doesn't actually encounter, it doesn't account for our experience of the presence of anything, just as pointing to the, you know, the color receptors in one's brain doesn't really, it doesn't actually explain the experience of it. This is a phenomenological account of presence, not the conditions for a, you know, a biological uprising of it. It's actually the conditions for how this experience is structured in the world. And Heidegger is saying that this attention is brought to bear on something, and it lets something manifest itself specifically over time. But it requires the attention of a being to disclose it.
And I think this will be, as we get into it, probably the most, I want to say controversial or the hardest thing to grasp for listeners or people who aren't as familiar, which is that, as Lawrence points out, and as we'll see, like Heidegger clearly, well, maybe clearly is not the right way of putting it, but, you know, points towards as well, is that there's something to do with humans, with like our human attention in the world, our embeddedness in the world, that allows entities to reveal themselves as to what they are. And this is like kind of a, I think, a controversial way of looking at things, because basically on some levels there's this notion that beings, entities in the world, they're the way that they show themselves, well, you know, as to what they are, has some dependency on human beings.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, for our listeners can't see this, but I have a pen in my hand right now. Mm-hmm. You know, the pen only has its qualities of being a pen within the context of it being used and related to other entities in that use and being historical and having some sort of relationship to me. And so it's revealed as a pen as such, mm-hmm. right? Like, there, it's not just that, like, pens wouldn't exist if, you know, everybody suddenly disappeared. Mm-hmm. I mean, I probably argue they wouldn't in a way, but it's that, like, the concept itself, the being itself, the entity, only makes sense in an active world.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of life that a human lives that gives rise to pens. A pen has an objective durability, but Heidegger would want to say that us ascribing its existence or its being to its persisting through time, independent, you know, time and space, and maintaining its form, that's derivative. It first of all exists. It first of all has come into the world. It's come into the world shaped in a certain way, pens are artifacts. They're created things for certain purposes, to certain ends. So yeah, it does. There's a different way of seeing the manifestation or the emergence of something historically in time in an actual world, and it's a completely different matter. It's a primary matter to the secondary matter of, okay, well, you know, okay, it looks like this because, well, the pen I'm holding has transparent, like a, you know, it's one of those cheap pens that's got the glass-like transparent case on the outside. And, well, it looks like that because light can pass through it. That's completely derivative of the fact that, well, maybe we wanted to create the transparent body so that we can tell how much ink is left in it, because we live in a world where you can deplete things. Things are mortal. Things get used, and sometimes we need to replace them, and that structures the creation of this pen in some way. So that you can see how there are different it might be argued a teleological way of viewing things, but I don't think Heidegger would. He might object to seeing things as teleological in a systematic way, but that our activity has certain forms, and that informs the tools we use to carry out those activities. I think that's what Heidegger would want to point to as the cause for the appearance of certain things.
You know, running on the back of that, I'm just going to take a little another note from Lawrence again, near the end of his article. Now, these are actually his words and not a Heidegger quote embedded in the actual work. He says, just basically, or summarizing what we've been talking about here for the listener, the prevailing view is that the universe consists of discrete entities that are ultimately related by physical laws. We relate to other entities by way of mental representations of the whole. We are something like scientific observers who don't really belong here.
Mm.
So for our listeners, that's the kind of second order scientific view that we're talking about, where what we believe to be real is this kind of objective observer view who tries to reduce things to their materialist qualities, effectively is a simple version of that. It says, but then on the with Heidegger's perspective, we belong here together with the trees and the stones and the pens, in this case, for we are made manifest together. Rather than being discrete entities, the relation comes first, and the extent to which we are related matters for what we and the stone ultimately are. Which I think, you know, to our listeners might sound a little bit more cryptic, but this idea that we are made manifest together is, again, this notion that, like, you know, in a sense, like when I use a tool, like a pen, the tools are a great example for Heidegger, obviously, and he was a big fan of them. Use a tool like a pen, an artifact like a pen, like you were saying, you know, it's not only revealing of the pen, but it's also revealing of myself as a writer, as someone who wants to convey information, as someone who's concerned with perhaps posterity or creativity. And those things are only revealed through, or an aspect of them being revealed is my relationship with the pen, right? It's like, there's no way around that. And I don't sit and blankly stare at the pen, you know, as Heidegger, his famous example is a hammer, but you can use the exact same with the pen, to really understand the pen, to have a close relationship with a pen, as funny as that sounds. You know, I don't blankly stare at the pen and observe its materialist qualities or whatever it might be. I use it, right? It is active. And in that activity, it is revealing of itself and myself.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you were, say you were like a pen designer, that's an activity too. You go out and you study certain instruments or pens or whatnot. So even, I think the interesting thing with Heidegger is that even though there is this kind of second order activity, that's still an activity that we can in fact find ourselves in. I mean, there are scientists, there are designers and whatnot, but it's not that The tradition, as it's understood, it has understood it as a kind of de-worlding process, but that's just not true. I mean, we still are in the world, even when we are making observations of it, which is interesting to, if you're going to say something.
Go ahead.
I was going to jump to what made me think of the other essay that we were looking over. So speaking about this idea of just observing things and kind of feeling de-worlded, but really coming up against this and taking it to its logical extreme. When I read this article, I immediately thought of another essay that I had read a long time ago, and I didn't totally, it was when I was first reading Heidegger, and I didn't really understand what was going on. I think that's kind of the point, is you struggle with this stuff, give up, and then come back, and it's just a bit different. But there is an essay titled Building, Dwelling, Thinking, where Heidegger is constantly talking about the presence that we have in the world and the presence of things in the world. But there is a passage in Building, Dwelling, Thinking that really took me by surprise. And I think even if the picture that we've been painting, maybe you have, you know, you're sympathetic to it, maybe you even understand it, this really pushes it. And it really confused me. And in certain ways, I think it's intended to sound very counterintuitive, but it's still in the same vein that Heidegger is talking about here. But it's this idea that, so let me just read it. So near the end of the essay, Heidegger asks his audience, because this would have been a lecture, he asks his audience, if all of us now think from where we are right here of the old bridge in Heidelberg, this thinking toward that locale is not a mere experience inside the persons present here. Rather, it belongs to the essence of our thinking of that bridge, that in itself thinking persists through the distance to that locale. This is a bit confusing, but that's okay. This is the kind of difficult bit. From this point right here, we are there at the bridge. We are by no means at some representational content in our consciousness. From right here, we may even be much nearer to that bridge and to what it makes room for than someone who uses it daily as an indifferent river crossing. So, and the picture that I had in my head was when I read this, I'm thinking of a specific bridge, a particular bridge that exists in the world. And what I take Heidegger to be saying is that if I am really attending to this bridge in my mind, I'm thinking about it, maybe even saying in my mind is a bit strange for Heidegger would contest. If I am thinking about this bridge, about its color, its shape, where it is, maybe what I've thought when I've crossed it, where I am right now, I am nearer to that bridge than a person right now who is walking across it and maybe like has their earbuds in listening to the radio or to music or something, or just thinking about where they need to go. That person is somewhere else.
You know, I remember this passage from, I've spent quite a bit of time with Heidegger when I was in university, and I've read this article or this piece multiple times, and I specifically remember this passage, and it has always remained a bit obscure to me, but I think you're touching on the right point, or getting there, where if someone is, it might be useful to use a term like authentic, mm-hmm. which would be a term that Heidegger would have used earlier in his thinking more commonly compared to this, but you know, if someone is really in touch with the sort of structure of being that Heidegger sort of elucidates, or at least tries to, it's kind of like you